Board Game Bros.
Hello, listeners.
Hey.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We are brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games. And it's a regularly scheduled episode where we are going to pick one board game. We are going to talk about it in depth. We're going to first give a short description. We'll go into how it's played. We'll talk about the strategies in the game. And then we'll do a little bit about the design at the end of the episode. So, Matthew, what game are we talking about today?
We are talking about a game called Role Player, designed by Keith Matejka. I think that's how you pronounce it. I apologize. And published by Thunderworks Games in 2016.
All right. Role Player. So just to give a brief description of what Role Player is. In Role Player, players play as players creating characters for a role-playing game. At the start of the game, each player is given a fantasy race, class, background, and alignment, and 8 dice that they roll and arrange into their 6 stats. The stats being strength, dexterity, constitution, intelligence, wisdom, and charisma. For the rest of the game, players acquire new dice to add to their stats, perform actions that manipulate your stat dice to desired sums, and acquire weapons, armor, skills, and traits that aid in the process of acquiring dice and modifying their stats, as well as scoring victory points. At the end of the game, players earn points for matching the goals of their class and background, which means having the right stat array. They also earn points from matching their alignment correctly, and also from scoring bonus points from traits and armor. At the end of the game, the player with the most points wins. And that is the gist of Role Player.
Yeah, that's pretty much... actually, that covers a good amount of the game now that I think about it.
yeah, I mean, it was pretty vague and broad. So
yeah, but much of the game is about meeting these objectives and getting victory points.
Right. If we could be a little more specific about that, we could say that to start with, you have your fantasy race, and it's the usual that you would expect to see in like a Dungeons and Dragons game. You know, you've got your human, your dwarf, your half-orc.
Your Tolkien-esque.
Yeah, Tolkien-esque Dungeons and Dragons, D20 fantasy-esque.
Yeah. I think fantasy there's races. A dragonborn in there.
Yeah, dragon or dragon folk, something
dragon
like that.
Dragonkin, yeah.
Right.
And then
so each race, of these, well, it should be said that each of these stats has each of these races has to a certain stat a bonus or penalty. So we for example, go ahead.
I was just going to say, we should also say there are 6 stats.
Yeah,
I mentioned that. And these are... Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah.
Strength, dexterity, constitution, intelligence, wisdom, charisma.
Right. Yes, and depending on your race, you'll have a +2 or a -2 to some of those stats. Is the human any different? Because usually in role-playing games...
I think the human has
nothing. Okay, the human's just even.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, so you have these stats, and then you get a class, which is, again, the typical, fantasy role-playing game classes. You know, you have fighter, barbarian, cleric, paladin, sorcerer, wizard, thief, or I guess rogue. No, it's a thief in this game. And bard, I think.
Yeah, well, so each of these comes on a card that has 2 sides.
Right.
And each of these cards is related to a specific stat.
I forgot Druid Ranger as well.
Yeah, Druid Ranger is Constitution, Fighter Barbarian is Strength, stuff like that.
Right. So you have these classes, and they also, each card has a color associated with it. So they go from, I think there's red for the Fighter, black for the Rogue, or red for the Fighter Barbarian, black for the Rogue. You get the idea. Each one just has a color associated. It's not so important. And then for each stat, or each class has the 6 stats listed on them. And then each stat has a target number that you have to reach by adding up 3 dice on your board. It also will give you a number of points when you meet that goal, or if you've met that goal at the end of the game. Your best stats, so like the primary stat that you're focusing on for, like, for example, a wizard sorcerer, that would be intelligence. It's usually going to be a 17 or an 18 in order to score that stat. So you have to have your dice have to add up to exactly 17 or 18, and that will usually give you 2, 3 or 4 points. And then you'll have sort of like minor stats, which are less important. They'll give you
two or three,
usually 2 points. And they usually require you to get somewhere around like 15 to 16 as the sum of all dice in that stat. And then your lower stats are only going to give you 1 point if you meet the goal at the end of the game. They are going to need either you to get 14 or higher in that stat in order to get that 1 point.
Yeah, so there are three different number formats these can come in. Mm-hmm. It's either like a static number, like just 18 or 17.
Mm-hmm.
It's a range between two numbers, so like 17-18 mm-hmm. means it could be either of those. And then there's anything higher than or equal to a number, so like 14 plus.
Right. Yes. So, and again, you could, and in some cases you'll get 4 points from your best stat. In other cases, you'll just get 3 points from your best stats and then 2 points from the moderate stats, and 1 point from the weakest stats. So that's your class and that's how you earn points from that. Then you have your background, which, it doesn't really translate flavorfully to what you need, but what it needs to do is, the dice in this game are, a bunch of different colors. There's one color die for every, color, class pair. So
basically,
like I said,
there's the six main colors.
Well, it's five pairs plus gold.
No, it's six pairs plus gold. Yeah.
Hold on, go through them for me if you can.
Okay, so there's red, which is fighter barbarian.
Right.
Black, which is thief assassin. Green, which is druid ranger.
Okay.
There's white, which is paladin cleric. Blue, mm-hmm. which is wizard sorcerer. And magenta, which is bard enchanter.
Got you. Okay, I was adding thief and bard together and forgetting assassin and enchanter. Those are less common fantasy classes, but yeah, so those are in the game. Anyway, so yes, there's the six main colors, like you just listed out, and then there's also gold dice for a total of seven different colors of dice. For the background, it will so the way that your stats are presented on your board is that each stat has three slots on it for you to put a die, so you could consider it like three columns of dice. And the background will ask that you have dice of a specific color in certain specific slots in those columns. So it might say, like, you need to have a red die in the strength row farthest to the left, and then a white die in the next row on the right side, and then a green die in the third row in the center, so on and so forth. Those are worth, you only get 1 point if you have three or less of those in the correct spaces. You get 3 points if you have four or five dice in the correct spaces for your background. And then if you get all six of them, the correct colors in the correct spaces, you get 6 points.
Yeah.
The next thing you get to start the game with is your alignment. So your alignment will have some sort of, descriptive name to it, like, I don't know. Can you give me some examples, Matthew?
Narcissist.
Right.
Or I know that's one. I honestly can't think of.
And then you'll have a grid, a 3x3 grid, and you start with a little marker in the center. And it's the classic chaotic, lawful, and
good and evil
array. So when you have like the narcissist, then you're probably the chaotic evil sorts, maybe, or maybe neutral chaotic.
Yeah. So anyways, the way this is presented is a 3x3 grid,
right,
with certain spaces giving you points and certain spaces removing points.
Right.
So for narcissist, it was that the bottom three, which were all on the evil side, I think,
mm-hmm.
were all plus 3 points. And then the top side, which was all good, was minus 3 points.
Gotcha. In other cases, it'll be there's a plus 3 point on one space, and it'll be flanked by plus 1 point spaces next to it. And then on the opposite side, there'll be a minus 3 and a couple minus 1s, or maybe even just 3 minus 1s.
And so your little cube starts in the center of this, which usually will give you no points, but sometimes it does.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are things you can do in the game to move it around that grid.
Right. Especially your wisdom ability, which we'll get into, the stat abilities real soon.
Yeah.
Actually, let's do that now.
Yeah. So,
okay. So
first we should talk about turn, the first thing you do in a turn.
Okay, yeah, how to set up the board, I guess.
Yeah, the first player rotates around the board clockwise every turn, mm-hmm. or every round. The first player will draw five dice from a bag with four players, right?
It's one plus the number of players.
Yeah. So for four players, which is what we did, it was five dice. And they roll those, and then they align them on these cards that are numbered one to however many players there are plus one. So one to five for us. And then, so they arrange these based on lowest to highest. So number one is going to have the lowest value showing on one of these dice, and number five is going to have the highest. If there are multiple dice with the same value, then the person who rolled them chooses how they get arranged.
Right.
Then players go clockwise, taking turns, choosing one of these cards with the dice on it, and takes the card and the die, and puts the die in one of their slots on their board. It has to be the leftmost slot in whatever column they put it in.
Correct. And when you do that, you also get to keep the card, which will come into play in the second part of a turn. So when you put your die into a slot on one of your stats, then you perform a special action determined by which stat you slotted the die into. So just to go through those, if you put your die in a slot for the strength stat, then you get to pick one die in your stat array and flip it upside down. So if it had a 1 on its face, you flip it to a 6, a 2 flips to a 5, a 3 flips to a 4, and also vice versa for all those things.
Yeah.
If you put a die in the dexterity slot, then you get to choose two dice on your array and switch their positions with one another. So you could choose one of your dice in your strength stat and one of your dice in your charisma stat and switch them.
But you keep the faces face up that are already face up.
Right. And nothing else shifts around. Like if you switch the leftmost die with the rightmost die, then the right, you know, they go to the leftmost and rightmost spots. Next one is Constitution. When you place a die in the Constitution stat, you get to choose any die and increase it or decrease its face value by 1. So you can turn a 5 into a 6 or you can turn a 3 into a 2.
Yeah.
If you put your die in the intelligence slot, then you get to re-roll any die.
And then put it back where it was.
If you choose to put your die in the wisdom slot, then you get to shift your alignment one space in any direction. So you can move it left or right. You can move it up or down. And then and that means you're moving your little cube in your alignment tracker in one direction. And then if you put your die in the charisma slot, then you get a token for the rest of that turn that will allow you to purchase a card from the market at one less gold piece. And with that, let's
get to the market.
Yeah. After
everybody's drafted their dice and cards and placed their die on their board, you go to the market phase.
Now, in the setup, the first player should have also laid out a number of cards in the market equal to the number of players plus one.
Yeah. So then in the market phase, you go in turn order based on the numbers on the cards you drafted. So the person who drafted card number one gets to pick from the market first.
Now, you can either choose to buy something using the gold that you have, or if you don't want to buy anything or if you don't have enough gold, you can choose to just get rid of a card from the market and earn 2 gold.
Right. And the main ways you get gold are when you fill in the third spot in a single row on your board for a stat, then you will get 1 gold. And then there are yellow dice that when you place them, you get 2 gold.
Mm-hmm. They're the dice that don't correspond to any of the classes and don't show up on any of the backgrounds.
Yeah.
And then you also will get a gold if you pick the middle dice in the dice picking phase. So when they're all laid out, like you said, the lowest number die goes on the 1, the highest goes on the highest number, which in our case was a 5 in a 4-player game. The 2 through 4 slots will also give you a gold if you pick those dice because they were middle of the pack. So they rewarded you for that there. And then you start the game with a number of gold coins, depending on if you were dealt any yellow dice at the beginning of the game, or if you filled up any of your stats at the beginning of the game.
Yeah.
So yeah, and so the person with the one goes first and buys or discards a card from the market to get money, and then it continues 2, 3, 4, and 5.
Right. There are three main types of cards in the market that you will be able to buy.
Four? Yeah. Weapons and armor are different things.
Oh, right. So, okay. So let's start with weapons.
Okay.
Weapons are items that you can only carry two hands worth. They'll have little hand icons on the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And they typically give you more money, it seems like.
Yeah, it seems like they help with how you acquire cards.
Yeah.
So they might
get more cards.
They might reward you with a little bit of extra gold if you perform certain actions, or they might just discount certain things that you purchase from the market.
Right.
But yeah, you can only have two of those. Well, it depends. There's some items that take up both of your hand slots, so you can only have one or two of those at any time. Any other card in the game, you can have as many as you want.
Right. Then there are armor.
Mm-hmm.
And the first part of armor is that each one corresponds to two classes. So it'll be like if you're a blue class or a purple class or something. And they'll give you an extra point if you are that class.
Right.
Then additionally,
go ahead.
And then additionally, the main thing is that armor comes in sets. So like there's leather armor, there's mystical armor, chain armor.
Yeah.
And for based on the number of armor you have in a set, you get points.
Right. It's different for each set of armor. Some sets have four pieces to them. Some sets have five. Some sets have three. And the value increases in different increments for each piece that you have in a set, depending on the set. And actually, I'm not very familiar with how much each set is worth, but I think to start, it's only worth 1 point. And then plus the additional point if you match the class of the armor, and then it just goes up from there. You know, the next piece might be worth 3 points now for the set or something like that. So that's armor. The next type of card is a skill. And a skill is a effect that you can use multiple times. It always will require you to shift your alignment in a direction to perform the skill. So for example, there's a skill called Greed. And what it does is you can activate it by shifting your alignment one step down, which is evil. And it lets you take a die, lower its value by one, and then collect 2 gold. So the thing with skills is that you can't use them if your alignment piece can't move further in that direction. If it's up against the edge that you intend to push your alignment token down into, you can't use a skill in that case. What was I going to say? After you use a skill, you turn it sideways to indicate that you've used it. You can use any number of skills during a turn as you want, but you only get to refresh one skill at the end of a turn, which means you turn it upright again. So you can use like 3 skills on a turn. At the end of the turn, you can only upright one of them, which you can then use the next turn if you want. So that is how skills work. And then Matthew, what are traits? The last card.
So traits are, they typically are like bonus objectives that at the end of the game will give you extra victory points for completing. And usually these will be different than what your cards that you get at the start can even do. So there's a bunch that will be like, if you have, if either of two stats are under 8, then you get 2 points at the end of the game.
Mm-hmm. Or it could say something like, if you get 3 points at the end of the game for every row of stats that has 3 of the same number on the dice.
Yeah.
Or 5 points at the end of the game for every column that has 5 or more of the same number.
Yeah, exactly. These are, like I said, bonus objectives that give you extra victory points, but are harder to get when you do alongside your other stuff.
And then when you acquire a trait, you usually also have to slide your alignment token in a certain direction.
But it is not required.
Right.
As in, if you don't have the space to move your alignment that direction, you can still get the trait.
Right. So that's the gist of the different mechanical parts of the game. Now, just to reiterate, at the beginning of the game, you get six random dice drawn from a bag for each player. You roll those six dice, and then you place them in your stat array to start your character. When you do this at the beginning of the game, you don't use any of your ability, your stat abilities. You don't get to, like, for example, flip a die over if you put some into strength. You do get the gold if you manage to fill out any of your stats. It's up to you how you arrange your dice in your stats at the start of the game. But I believe this would be a good place to start talking about strategy now, because the strategy of the game starts here. Or I guess you could maybe say it starts when you choose your class, just because you might want to choose a class that goes well with your race.
Right, like, and each class also has a special ability.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right.
That will make certain dice or certain actions better.
Right.
Like, the thief is whenever you place a gold die, you get 4 gold instead of 2.
Mm-hmm. I had the paladin when we played, and the paladin said if you start a turn with your alignment die on a space that would give you 3 points, then you get to collect a gold at the beginning of the turn. So you want to choose a class that works well with your race, like the higher requirement stats on the class line up with where you're getting your bonuses, and they don't line up with where you're getting your penalties. And then, yeah, you want to, I would suggest you want to choose something on your class that gives you money rather than points, because you're going to need money in this game, and getting it from your class is probably your most safest, reliable source. So then you roll your 6 dice, and then you get to put them into your stats, and there's, I'd say, 2 ways of going about placing them. Two of the best ways to go about placing them would be to either put 2 dice into 2 stats and then 1 die into the remaining 4, or put 2 dice into 3 stats, put 1 dice in 2 of the remaining stats, and then keep one open. Huh? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sorry. You get 8 dice.
You were saying 6. Yeah, I was going to say. Doesn't sound right.
I misspoke. Yes, you get 8 dice to start the game. My bad. Okay, 8 dice. So, yes, 2 in 2 stats, 1 in the remaining 4, or 2 in 3 stats, 1 in the remaining 2 of the 3, and then keeping 1 stat completely open.
Yeah.
Essentially, most of the stat abilities are fairly useful at different points in the game, so you're going to want to have access to at least 1 slot in any given stat. Although I have written down a tier list of sorts for these stat abilities.
I do too.
And looking at it now, I think it might even go in the order that they're written down, to some degree, for at least for my tier list. So let me hear your tier list first.
Okay, so first off, high tier is strength and dexterity.
Absolutely.
These give the most drastic changes, and they also are the most efficient because of that, I guess. They do the important jobs.
Yes.
Because so many of the requirements that you'll want require high numbers, so you need like a lot of 6s and 5s.
Yep. I mean, just getting 14 in a stat means that you need 2 5s and a 4.
Yeah.
Which, you know, those are well above average on a die roll.
Strength, since it flips something over, it turns your 1s and 2s into 5s and 6s,
mm-hmm.
which is super good. And
huge
then
change.
Dexterity is also really useful when you try to work in your background, because I haven't had problems working with my background, as in like getting all 6 of the correct dice in the correct spots.
Mm-hmm.
But partially because I use dex a lot of times to move dice around.
It should be said, with back to putting those 8 dice in the initial slots, you should try to match up as many as you can in that first thing, because that'll be probably the easiest chance you get to match some of those up.
Yeah.
I have strength significantly above dexterity. In terms of usefulness, just because low dice translate to earlier buys, strength combos well with the ability. It grants you the ability to take really good buys at really low dice numbers, and then later you can flip them with strength. So I have that as my number one stat, and if when you're starting the game, if you choose to leave one of your stats completely open so that you have three opportunities to use it, I would suggest having strength be that stat.
Yes. Yeah. So anyways, after those two, I have wisdom and constitution.
Yep.
So constitution is similar to strength. It lets you make things big. And
or small, which can sometimes small, also which be can, useful.
Yeah. It lets you micromanage your dice better.
Mm-hmm.
And then wisdom is because not only does it move your alignment, but it lets you use more skills.
Yes.
And skills are almost always very good.
The skills, essentially, I think it's safe to say that a skill is worth like 1.5 stat abilities.
Yeah, that's what I was going
to
say.
You'll be mostly relying on your stat abilities to make sure everything is all lined up and correct, but having those extra skills is just going to make your turns that much more fit. I mean, it's like having an extra turn and a half, if you think about it, just because, we like to talk about things in manners of extra turns, and if a turn is using a stat ability and a skill is worth a stat and a half, then, you know, it's just good to be able to use those. And wisdom is something that you need to keep open in order to be able to use important ones. Because if you use a skill too many times, then you're going to find yourself with your alignment token all the way up against the edge.
Yeah.
You need to push it back a space before you can use that skills again. I mean, those skills again.
And if you think about it, you start in the center of your card. And then once you use one skill, you're stuck against that wall.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah. And not to mention that it might not seem like you get it at first, but this game does have a hard turn count.
Mm-hmm.
Because it ends when everybody fills up all of their spaces, which would, you know, when you think about it, be at the same time.
Mm-hmm. And that happens in, 12 turns?
Let's see. 3 times 6 is 18, so 10 turns.
10 turns, right.
Yeah, so the faster and more often you can use skills in those 10 turns means you're basically taking more turns than everybody else. You know,
and just by taking one extra turn, that puts you, you know,
ahead technically
ahead by 15% or whatever. Yeah, yeah, very good.
Yeah, and then the last two, I have charisma and then intelligence.
So you put charisma above intelligence. So I put intelligence above charisma.
That's fair.
Just because, a reroll is, randomness is usually not a good thing when you're working, especially in a game like this where you have to plan so far ahead with where your dice are supposed to end up. Intelligence is kind of something that tries to do what strength does, but will fail more like half the time, or won't be as good five sixths of the time. So
I just want to say, I think the best numbers to use intelligence on are threes.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, at least because you have a 2 out of 6 chance to do worse, and then you have a 1 out of 6 chance to do just the same, and then a 50% chance to do better. And that's not bad.
Then
more than
also,
50% ain't bad.
If you have strength open, then that 2 out of 6 becomes a, you know, it's not even doing worse at that point.
Well, it is in that it's soaking up one of your uses of strength, which you have only so many of.
But it's less bad in that case.
Charisma, I put below intelligence because what charisma does is it gives you a token that makes you, it gives you basically a temporary gold piece for that turn to spend at the market. But if you want to buy the thing that you want to buy with that temporary gold piece, then you need to put a small number in there. So if you're a class that only gets 1 point from charisma, then charisma is fine. I'd probably value it higher than intelligence in that case. If you have a class that doesn't value charisma, otherwise, if your charisma will give you 2 or 3 points, then I'd say it's worse than intelligence.
Sure.
So in general, at the start of the game,
it's just because for most items and stuff you can buy, most cards in the market,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't seem like the 1 gold makes enough of a difference. As in, like,
yeah,
I mean, most things cost between 4 and 5 gold.
I mean,
and
yeah,
if
and
you
can...
can't afford a 5,
you
that's
probably can.
Because you already weren't thinking of buying the 4s.
Uh-huh.
But
Plus, yeah, like, if you're short on gold one turn, the next turn, it's real easy to make up for it just because you can get, you can pick up a gold die, you can fill out a stat line, that's a 3-point swing. And then the turn before, when you didn't buy anything, that was also 2 coins. So you basically make up 5 coins in one turn. Yeah.
When we played it this week, I think there was only one turn where I said, I really need to get this one card in the market.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
There's not many times where you actually, it's not important that you get a given card. You can often make up for missing a card one turn.
Yeah. And I think that would bring up a point of strategy for me where you probably don't want to try to focus on the armor, because I think the armor has the potential to be worth the most points in the game out of anything except for your class. But that's only if you get the full set, which we experienced this when we played. Oftentimes, 2 pieces from the same armor set would show up in the market, and you can't get both of them. So, right. unless you maybe have like a skill that does so, which is rare, just because of the shuffle, you shouldn't focus on that. Instead, you should probably just focus on like short term buys. Like for this turn, this is all right for me, and this is worth some points, and that's worth some points.
I want to give another perspective on that, though.
Okay,
which is that as far as points go, there is a certain limit, and the cards in the market are the best way to exceed that limit. The limit being what's on your character.
Yeah,
and traits often require a trade off in some way. Because, like, a lot of them either require going against your like, class. So, like, instead of getting 1 star from or 1 point from a given stat, you'll get 2 by having it lower.
Mm-hmm.
Or they require a ton of work. Items require no work and no trade-off. Armor, I mean.
Okay. That's a good point.
So it's kind of free points. Like, it might be only 2 points if you get one that's... Or if you get only one, that's for your class, but that's a free 2 points that didn't take any extra actions, ideally.
My thought is just that you should try, for every card that gives you points, so for every trait or piece of armor that'll give you points at the end of the game, I think there's a general rule of thumb in this game that it should give you at least 3 points.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing for traits.
So my thought is that it's riskier and more difficult. And also, I mean, consider this. If you have 2 pieces of chainmail and then somebody is ahead of you in the market phase, it might be just all too easy for them to see that and say like, oh, well, I'm just going to trash the 3rd piece of chainmail. So you're not going to get chainmail this round. So I think it's too risky to go for armor. Just at some point, by the time when armor is worth at least 3 or more points per piece, it may be just wasted effort.
And what I'm trying to say is that for the most part, it's worth it even if you just get only 1 piece, as long as that wasn't like as long as you're not expecting to get a full set, it's good. Like if you're not really tight on gold, mm-hmm. then it's just free points.
Are you saying if there's nothing else worth buying in the
because I
was valuing last night or the other day when we played, I was valuing traits way higher than armor for the whole game. Like I was way more interested in getting traits and then just earning the free points from those.
Right. And that goes back to what I was saying is that not every trait is free. You would only be able to get so many that actually fit with everything else you're doing.
Now, when you say that the traits that give you points for tanking stats, are, I mean, I actually value those as some of the best cards in the game.
Right. I do think those are good, too, because they let you dump stats.
They let you dump stats, which means that you put low numbers in there. This is good in this game because, I mean, having a low number means you get a sooner buy.
Right. So here's what I was trying to say is that, like, those are good when they already fit with what you're doing because it takes no extra actions to meet it.
Mm-hmm.
But the armor already takes no extra actions.
And what I'm saying is it's easy to accommodate traits. Like, it's easy to just dump stats.
Well, some of them, like the ones that require 3 dice of the same color in a row or... like all the dice in a column being the same number.
Okay. Those, I can see
those
are pretty...
If there's nothing else worth buying, Like, if somebody already bought the trait you wanted, mm-hmm. armor is fine.
Sure. Okay, then maybe okay. We could just go back to the rule of thumb. Like, if you can get 3 points out of it, then it's worth your time. If not, then just get, like, armor or something else.
Yeah, there we go.
Or focus on getting skills that give you good effects.
Yeah.
Because skills are very good. You only have 10 buys throughout the whole game. So, yeah, maximizing the points that you get from those buys and the skills that you can use to just sort of keep the tempo up for yourself throughout the game is important in this game.
Yeah. I think that's about it for my strategy points.
I have one last piece of strategy, and that's that I think it's probably okay to tank stats anyways, at least one stat anyways.
Oh, yeah.
Just because your worst stat is only worth 1 point, and it's worth it just to trade that for one or two priority buys on important things.
It's really hard to get all six of your stat goals reached.
Very hard.
And I think because, like, if you designate one of those 1-pointer stats as a dump stat, it makes your life way easier.
You could also just
focus as much on numbers, and
you could also consider it like you're wasting 3 turns just to get 1 point. It's more useful to spend those 3 turns getting 3 points by either working to ensure that one of your primary stats will meet its goal, or you're getting traits or items that, you know, will give you really good.
Because this way you can get those low number dice, mm-hmm. and get the lower initiative cards without having to worry about how to turn those dice into big dice.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
One last thing also is money at the start of the game is pretty swingy because it's almost entirely dictated by whether or not you're dealt gold dice at the beginning of the game. So if you aren't dealt gold dice at the beginning of the game and you have very little money, then it's best just to take the lowest possible die when it's your turn, get the early buy, and then spend your buy trashing something that the person with the most money would want. So if, for example, you get to choose the first buy, somebody has 6 gold and there's that 6 gold trait that says any stat you have with 5 or less is worth 2 points at the end of the game, just trash that because the person with the 6 gold probably wants that.
Oh, and if you can, I think turn 3 is the latest you would want to get an item.
Mm-hmm.
Because most of them, like, they have worse returns over as the game goes on.
Right.
So, like, you'd want to ideally get an item early to get the most money off of it.
Exactly, because items, again, usually involve discounting things or giving you money. I mean, same thing, there's diminishing returns on the skills, although that happens a little bit later, probably a little after halfway through the game.
Yeah.
New skills will be less beneficial for you. You'll have less opportunities to use them. It's very good to get skills that have opposite alignment shifts so that you can just keep using them over and over in combination.
Back and forth.
It could also just be useful to get a skill that shifts your alignment one way and then be on the hunt for traits that shifts your alignment the other way. That gives you more skill activations.
Yeah.
All right, that's it. That's all that I have for strategy. So let's go into the design.
All right.
So I'll start by saying this is a fairly elegant game. There's a lot of things that sort of blend into other components in this game that just kind of make sense, like the very obvious trade-off of a low die for priority in buying, you know, the trade-off getting the gold for picking a middle die.
Yeah, it's actually kind of nice, like, that the game at least is pretty component light. Like, mm-hmm. there's not too many different types of components. And a lot of the components are multi-purpose.
Right. The die will not only activate an ability when you put it in a stat, but the face of the die will also add up at the end of the game. Plus, the face of the die could sometimes mean the opposite side face in case you plan on shifting it with strength later on.
Expand on elegance, another part of what I think elegance means in terms of game design is having large gameplay implications by a simple concept.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, even, like, being able to flip a die over has big consequences in this game.
Or better yet, being able to exchange the position of two dice. Because not only does it mean that you can change the sums of the dice in those two rows so that you can meet a skill requirement, but you could also meet your background requirement by shifting a die of a certain color into the right space. Or you could meet a trait, like a trait that requires you to have dice of the same number. You can meet that, and that's just through this one simple action. There's so much depth to it. It means a lot in this game.
Yeah. I
think
wanna...
because of that, it makes the decisions that you have to make in the game pretty obvious, which is a good thing. You know, it's obvious it's, when you make the decision that your low die roll is going to give you a higher priority in the market pick. You know, that just stands out right away. Anyone can guess that, and then anyone can sort of use that knowledge to make decisions. So
the way I picture the game sort of decision tree is there are macro decisions and micro decisions,
mm-hmm.
or like sub decisions. So choosing which die you get is a macro decision because it's pretty obvious. There's a very clear cause and effect of what it does. Same thing with like buying a skill or buying a trait. Now the micro decisions are much harder. That's like when you get a die, which row do you put it in? And if you put it in a row, you know, like what do you do with that ability? Because there's so many like very tight differences
mm-hmm.
in what different abilities will do. So like, and I think one thing is that like this game, there's a lot of ways you can manipulate the dice that you draft, but even then it feels so crowded and cramped.
Yeah, it's kind of funny how in this game it's like you have eight ways to change one die number into another die number, you only have enough time for one or two of those ways, and it's a little difficult to actually decide that. And also, I mean, it's like you have a limited menu of these methods of manipulating dice. So you might think to yourself as you're playing the game, you're like, oh, I can just use strength to flip that later. And then you might think that about four different dice. And if you don't catch yourself thinking that about four different dice, then you won't realize that, oh, I don't have enough strength activations to do that.
This is something I noticed when we were playing it, is that everybody would be really quick to choose which die and which card they get, but then actually placing the die took a lot longer.
Right. And I mean, like, that's in part due to the fact that sometimes you were just like, give me the biggest die. Or sometimes you were just like, give me the littlest die. I want to buy something.
Give me the die of the color I need.
Right.
Yeah. And, I want to talk a bit about math.
Talk about math.
So, or actually, this is more of a memory thing. So,
yeah. Oh, yeah. I want to talk about memory too.
Yeah. So, one of this game's biggest problems is the amount of memory and mental work you have to do.
Yeah. It takes up a lot of mental space.
Yeah. So, because if you think about it, it's a resource management game that encourages you to plan ahead in terms of what numbers you get, where you put them, how you use your abilities and stuff like that.
Because it's all kind of laid out to you. You know exactly how many times you can use the rest of your abilities and what they'll do to your dice. And you could even go so far as to say, like, if I get a low number, I know that I can use constitution then this, or I could use strength and that. And, you know.
Yeah, there's honestly very little press your luck or like true random aspect.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so it becomes, like I said, this deterministic resource management thing. And so because of that, and because you have to always think about like six numbers and then the positions of the actual dice on your board, like I found myself constantly adding up, like, all right, I have a six and a five, so if I want to get 16, I need that's five. And then I'd forget about it because I move to another column or row.
I mean,
yeah, another row.
Yeah. Essentially, there's 28 things that you have to keep in mind every turn of the game. There's the 8 dice, or there's the 18 dice that you'll eventually have on your board, plus the 10 actions that you have available to you at the start of the game, the one that you get to take each round. So I guess it's 28 things, and then by the end of the game, it's still 18 things you need to keep in mind on any given turn.
It might be like, wait, I want to switch around these dice so that it allows me to put a color here that adds up a certain way, but then wait, that would put this one at a wrong number, so I'll need to flip this over. And it's like there's just a lot of, and if you think about it, every action requires it adding three numbers together to figure out if you want to do it or not. And that sounds really simple when you isolate it, but when you think about how many there are and how there's 10 turns of this, it gets to be a lot.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that it asks for specific numbers in a lot of cases, because that just makes it just like twice as hard, is because you're not trying to get over a certain threshold. You're trying to meet a certain target number, which means your math has to be exact in all of your calculations. It's,
you know,
it's a lot to keep track of.
You know, it's weird. So this is sort of a roll and write game, kind of like Yahtzee. Sort of the family of games where you roll dice and you mark their values.
Not a game that was designed by a man named Roland Wright.
Yeah. Brother of Will Wright, EA designer. No, it shares a lot of stuff with those games. Like, you roll and then the value of the dice is permanent in a way.
Yeah.
Or, like, low numbers don't necessarily mean worse than high numbers.
Mm-hmm.
But the difference is, roll and write games, you're allowed to write things down.
Mm-hmm.
In this game, it doesn't come with a paper pad to write down things or take notes on.
I mean, this is a roll and write game that is written on a dry erase board.
Yeah, but, like, what I mean is, like, honestly, if I were to go back and play this again, I'd kind of want to have a notepad so I can take notes while I'm playing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's weird.
My thing about this game is that I am a frequent user of the set it and forget it method when it comes to strategizing in board games, where I will think to myself, I'll think about portions of my turns, like a portion of the next turn I'll take or a portion of the turns I'll take in this game. And I can make a clear decision, like, obviously, eventually, next turn or in this game, I need to do this. Like, using this game as an example, I need to take my strength action and flip the one in the charisma row into a 6 so that at the end of the game, I'll make that number. Or, as another example, I could say that in my charisma row, I need either a 3 or a 4, and it needs to be red. So if I see a 3 or 4 red, I'll pick it up. And then I'll just keep that in mind at the back of my mind, and then the rest of my mind can be used to come up with more interesting strategies, like planning for the future, considering traits in this game, and if I'm going to be able to get at least 3 points from them. So I like to set it and forget it, but this game makes you take care of these numbers so often and keep in mind so many things. And also you can't be too careless with setting and forgetting it, because sometimes you'll come to a situation where you'd say to yourself, oh, I can just use strength to flip that. And then you tell yourself that 4 times to 4 different dice. And before you know it, you've used up all your strength and you still have things you want to flip. So I guess what I'm getting at is, this game, I think for everyone, it forces people to do this kind of method, which I imagine most people, or a lot of people, probably don't want to do that. They either want to think about everything very carefully, or maybe they'll just do something random. Oh, by the way, sorry for the AC kicking on just now. I guess that's kind of a problem, in that it's making you keep track of so many things that setting and forgetting it is kind of necessary, but also kind of dangerous.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think this is a game that expects players to make mistakes due to their own mental capacity. It's expecting you to be stupid. I'm saying that it's expecting you to make suboptimal decisions because you can't manage, you know, most people can't manage handling all these things
exactly.
At once.
Yeah, I mean, unless you're a math savant or something, and you can like multiply four digit numbers,
people out there who this is perfect for.
Oh, perfect in that they can do very well in the game because the math comes very easy to them.
Yeah,
but most people will find this game unwieldy. I guess is a way to put it. Hard to manage.
I think it's weird for a game to tell the to like. I feel like it's weird for a game to be designed sort of with this knowledge that it's going to be extremely difficult for players to do everything well, but that's what adds the skill curve.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm trying to say is, like, I mean, obviously, any game that has a skill curve in general, you're going to be bad at it at some point, and then you'll get better.
Mm-hmm.
And skill difference is being good and bad, but, like, saying that, you know, the reason why you can't get better isn't because you're not practicing enough. It's just that, you know, mentally there's nothing you can do about it.
You know, there's an odd feeling in this game that doesn't come about in a lot of games. We mentioned in our Concordia episode how if you mess up, then you have to take a number of turns to fix it. In this game, you don't know you've messed up until the very end of the game.
Yeah, let me get into this point that I kind of wanted to rant on.
Is it the same thing that I just, is it?
Yeah, setup.
Okay. Yeah.
So setup requires you to put 8 dice into different positions, dice of different colors with different numbers that have different outcomes and purposes as the game goes on. And it asks you to do this before you even take anybody's first turn. And not only that, it doesn't give new players a chance to see what those things they covered up would do.
Mm-hmm.
This is more of a problem, I think, with getting new players into the game. Is that, like, so a lot of games will wait for you to make super important decisions until, like, you've gotten a chance to see what the basic building blocks of those decisions would do. Mm-hmm. So it wouldn't make you, you know, put something into strength until you have gotten a chance to see another player do something with strength. Because, like, you might look at it and be like, oh, it turns a 1 to a 6. But you might not realize how good that actually is until you see somebody do it.
Right.
It's different types of learning.
You might mistakenly put a die in the strength column or in the strength row when in actuality, the best strategy is to keep it wide open, possibly.
Yeah. And you don't know, you know, that this is a thing, but at the setup, you've already filled in half your spaces and you can't really, it's not like you can change them. You know, in a typical way,
mm-hmm.
like you can't go back, but it feels like so much to ask at the start of a game.
You also only see 4 of the cards from the market or a handful of cards from the market deck, a small portion.
Yeah.
You know, you have enough cards to play out more than 10 turns of this game and you only get to see less than 10% of them. And so even then you don't know like what you might be trading off putting things in certain places.
It's like the game is asking you to do these huge things during setup before you've gotten accustomed to them.
Mm-hmm.
And since you probably won't figure out that they had a big deal until halfway through the game, like that can feel awful that you doomed yourself and that halfway through the game, you're stuck in a rut and your best hope at winning the game is to play it again.
Right. So I guess we're kind of talking about 2 situations
in which
you are feeling that you've messed up or you've realized that you've messed up. And in your situation that you just described, there's nothing you can do because you messed up at the beginning of the game. And before in my situation, there's nothing you can do because it's the end of the game and you have no opportunities to fix it. It's a bad feeling, obviously, in the middle of the game when you can't do anything, but you still have to finish the game. But it's a confusing feeling when it's at the end of the game. I'm not sure whether or not it's entirely a bad thing.
You know, I think if it's at the end of the game, you have the benefit that you don't have to play the game for that longer.
Mm-hmm.
And in some games, that could actually be a good thing.
Yeah. Because
in some games, you know, like realizing at the end that there was something maybe midway through you could have done might make you want to play again more.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just interesting that it's like you messed up and it's the end of the game. So what are you going to do? I guess. Yeah. In some cases, it's not bad because you're like, well, I messed up. But, you know, what are you going to do? It's the end of the game.
Let me put it like this. It's like if you go to an amusement park and you're on a and you're getting in line for a roller coaster, and the roller coaster breaks down while you're in line, or it breaks down when you're on like the car before it left the station. Yeah. Like on one in one hand, you have to wait even longer because you're in the line. On the other hand, you're on the roller coaster, so what's a few more 10 minutes going to make? Even though it's the same amount of time lost.
Yeah, I guess so.
That's sort of what I was trying to mean. And part of the problem with like making you do these big decisions, I've noticed this with a couple different people that I play games with. There's a lot of people that don't just get analysis paralysis. They get bad analysis paralysis when they have incomplete information.
Okay.
I call this incomplete analysis paralysis, which is that, like, our dad is the main example, actually. Shout outs to our dad. That a decision can be a lot harder to make, not when you're not sure what the best decision is, but you're not sure how to tell what the best decision is.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, our dad took a bit longer to set up the board, even though, like, none of us really knew quite what the best way to set it up would be, just because he didn't really understand like what leaving certain some spots open might mean in the future, or all that, or you know what covering up some spots might entail. It's the fact that you don't know enough to feel like you're making a good decision. Mm-hmm. Like you don't know enough to be confident or comfortable with your decision.
Right.
This is a game that lends itself to that, which is preferable, I think, if you can avoid it. That's the other thing, though, is like, I mean, all of this said, this isn't like end all be all.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's people. Yeah.
Just some experiences that we've had in the game just results of the game's mechanics. I mean,
yeah,
but they're just some small experiences over the course of, you know, playing still a functional game that had a lot of interesting parts to it.
Yeah. And I will say, the theme of this game really fits.
Oh, yeah.
The idea that you're making an RPG character. Like, I'm sure people that enjoy min-maxing and theory crafting RPG characters will love this game.
Yeah, it very much captures the fiddly nature of that activity.
If anything, the theme excuses all the fiddly die aspects.
I don't know about excusing, but it explains it.
Yeah. I think it eases the pain a little.
Yeah.
I do want to talk a bit. Sorry, is there? I know I've been talking a lot. Is there anything else you wanted to mention?
I guess to tack onto that, it's also very flavorful that tanking stats can be very beneficial, because that's also just a straight up aspect of making an RPG character. Right,
yeah. I was gonna say my favorite thing about this game is the aesthetics and the theme. I think there's a lot of really creative uses of the flavor.
Yeah, I think the components and everything. Definitely very much capture the thing that the game is trying to represent. I think that visually, personally, it looks a little dull, at least just the graphics of it and everything.
It's kind of generic fantasy art.
The art is kind of really dark and muddy a little bit for all the different characters and items and stuff. The boards are also kind of dark and muddy, like they're literally all just like dark brown with some simple graphics on them.
I guess what I should say is, like, when they have a name for a thing, I understand why the thing has that name.
Yeah.
So, like, the alignments.
Everything very flavorfully aligns.
Yeah. The alignments make sense. The backgrounds, I haven't really thought to look into why they're named that way. I assume there's a method to the madness.
Yeah, I'm sure there's some sort of, like, semi-religious background that asks that you have a white die very high on a certain stat.
Yeah,
in the far right corner or something.
I like the color coding.
Mm-hmm.
This is sort of a personal thing, is I really like games that color code certain ideas. Mm-hmm. Again, it's just a personal thing. This is an end-all be-all, like I said, but I like how each class is related to a die color, which is sort of related to a stat.
Mm-hmm.
And the stats seem to match up with like typical colors for those stats. Like, you know, red is strength, magenta is charisma, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's helpful for me when I can use a color to sort of match things together, because colors are super recognizable. And if you can compartmentalize stuff to be like, you know, oh, I'm a bard, so I want the pink dice because those will give me more points and stuff like that.
Sure. Anything that helps to compartmentalize things and make shorthand of things, concepts in the game, to free up mental space for all the other calculations and plans that you have to make in this game is definitely a huge bonus. And especially, and in any other game, it's a bonus to do something like that.
Yeah.
I thought it could be cool to involve something. There's not a lot of player interaction. I mean, except for the fact that you can trash things from the trade row, which is a pretty big thing in this game. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of player interaction. But one thought that I had about this game is that aren't we... we're in competition with one another, which is counter to what you're actually doing when you're making a role-playing game character. You're trying to make a party composition that's unified. I thought it could be interesting if there were some sort of mechanic around that, like something that benefited from your allies making characters or something that benefited from you making a character that meshed well with your allies. These are just, I mean, this has nothing to do with the game, really. These are just thoughts I had.
Yeah, alternate game mode mod sort of homebrew things.
There's one thing about the design that I wanted to point out real quick, and that's the charisma skill. It's unfortunate that it's kind of counterintuitive, that the turn that you would get the most use out of it is the turn that you put a low stat die number into it. And so you're either wasting some of your strength activations by flipping that poor die because you had to take the lower die to get the better purchase so that you could use your charisma purchase bonus to acquire something. It also doesn't affect anything on your player board. It adds a mechanic that's entirely unique to just charisma when there's already gold pieces. I thought the charisma should have just given you gold or something like that. And so if your class is something that doesn't, or that needs high charisma, or if your class, or if your race is something that gives you a charisma penalty, then it's unfortunate that charisma works out that way. That it kind of depends on you picking a low number. And so it's the stat that will probably get tanked most often. Although maybe that's flavorful, because when I make Pathfinder characters or Dungeons & Dragons characters or anything, charisma is usually the first stat that I tank unless I'm a sorcerer.
That is true. It's like when I've played Pathfinder in D&D, it seems like the only people with a moderately high charisma are the charisma classes.
Mm-hmm. If your class doesn't care about charisma, that's usually the first thing to go.
Yeah.
So maybe there's a reason for that. Either way, it's kind of counterintuitive for the gameplay. None of the other stats force you to make that kind of a decision that, you know, the turn that you want to use it is the turn that you have to put a low number into it. That's the last thing I had to say about this game. Do you have anything else?
No, I'm good.
All right.
I just think this game should have been the one that's called Munchkin.
All right. So that's our episode on Dungeon Roll. Thank you for listening.
No, that's not Dungeon Roll. That's Role Player.
Role Player. Similar games. Dungeon Roll. It's a press your luck game. And it doesn't involve building characters. It involves rolling dice to go through a dungeon. Role Player. That's our episode on Role Player. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening.
If you want, you could follow us and leave comments on social media at BG Bros on Facebook and Twitter. You can also follow us and leave comments on any podcasting platform, or not comments, but reviews. If you like, you can go to our website, bgbcast.com, where we put all of our websites up and we tag them. You can search those tags for other games that we've reviewed and talked about, or concepts that we've talked about.
I just want to say you said the wrong Facebook and Twitter page. It's supposed to be BG Bros Cast.
BG Bros Cast, Facebook and Twitter, or bgbcast.com for our website. Yeah. If you go to tpublic.com/user/bgbcast, look us up. You can get our merch there. We are selling t-shirts, sweatshirts, hoodies, and the ilk. And Matthew, let's hear your own plugs.
I stream on weekdays from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Central Time, 4 being more like 3, which is sometimes 2. It's a bit flexible around that time.
To late afternoon.
Yeah, I stream on twitch.tv/twack. That's twitch.tv/twak. I play a lot of video games, those being I speedrun a game, I play fighting games and some other competitive games. I play a lot of roguelikes. I'm going to be starting a new RPG next week. So, yeah, keep an eye out for that. And we also have a Discord server through there where you can talk to us and such.
All right. Yeah. So, social media, website, TeePublic, Twitch, and Discord. Check it all out. And thank you for listening again.
Mm-hmm.